Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can also see this by video streaming by going to GaryNull.com. Today, the latest on why that nap can add years to your life. And if you're not eating tomatoes or drinking tomato juice, you should. Also, a nut that doesn't get a lot of attention is pecan, or where I come from, pecans. And why should we have more of them? For those of you who want to prevent mesothelioma, antioxidants, an apple a day, it does more than help prevent a cold, a lot more than keeping us just healthy. It actually increases our lifespan. But by how much? I'll share that with you as well. If you're drinking those sugar-sweetened drinks, I wouldn't. A new article in Hypertension Journal of the American Medical Association explains why. My guest, a little earlier than normal, because I think this might be one of those conversations that just is going to have to go a little longer, is Colin Murphy. Colin Murphy is the editor-at-large for Vanity Fair, and he's written a piece that we're going to explore about the dynamics and strategies of the Inquisition. We used to say, well, Gary, wasn't that 1296? Wasn't that one of seven? Yeah. And I believe that we have an Inquisition today in the United States that is very similar. But to understand it, you have to understand the original Inquisition and bureaucracies and developing a large data bank on each person. And not just the church, but secular organizations. Oh, I think this is going to be a very interesting insight into history from a different perspective. In our environmental segment today, we're going to talk about what some French scientists just discovered about what happens if you live even anywhere in the vicinity of a nuclear reactor. But hold on, aren't these the same French scientists that promote nuclear? Yeah. Now they got to let you know how bad it is. For the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they are celebrating $2 billion being spent from their foundation to promote genetically engineered foods to help the starving in Africa. A message back to them, your $2 billion would be much better spent supporting wells for clean water in Africa, clinics, and medications to treat existing diseases like malaria and tuberculosis, food banks with organically grown food and sustainable agriculture. Then you'd be saving lives. Did I mention that we filmed this year in India for a new documentary I'm doing? I wanted to know, why would a person drink Monsanto's genetically engineered chemical pesticides to kill themselves? Not one, not two. 250,000. What's it like to sit across from a family that the only way they could get out of their debt and the shame of that debt was to die? For Monsanto, and by extension, Bill Gates. So this message goes out to Bill Gates, Melinda Gates, and all the wonks that hang around with them. You know, the lottie-dotties, lottie-dotties. Well, there's a whole lot of people have another comment, and I'm going to be sharing it to the Gates Foundation. Drowning in hypocrisy. We're abroad, lots of money. Austerity at home, take it out of the mouths of children. Dr. Paul Greg Roberts gives a commentary. You'll have a chance to respond. And also, I'm not one of those people who believe that we can, on the one hand, praise a Steve Jobs for creating a unique computer system, which indeed he was a part of, and at the same time overlook how those computers are made and our responsibility of what happens in the lives of the people who suffer in order for us to have those toys. So from Robert Cruxbank, alternate, Apple driving workers to threaten mass suicide, the pathologies of the modern corporation. A morality tale. As you see, we have a packed program. Let's begin. Where I grew up in the South, as children, we were told, whether we liked it or not, more often not, we did not like it, to take a nap. And I remember when I was thinking about this, what it was like to lay there and want to be outside playing, and then looking out the window and seeing everyone else playing, thinking, can I climb out the window and sneak down? Which I tried, and as I'm sneaking down the pipe, the drain pipe, as I go by the kitchen, there's my mom looking at me, and I look at her, and she kind of motions with her finger, go back up, so I shimmy back up the pipe, and lay there, but couldn't nap. Today, we need to nap. Science Daily says the following, quote, napping can help with blood pressure management. Quote, a daytime sleep could have cardiovascular benefits, according to new research from a major study at Allegheny College in Pennsylvania. Long work schedules, shift work, increased anxiety, and a greater use of the internet and television late at night, all characteristics of our modern society, have had an impact on nocturnal sleep. We no longer sleep as long as we used to. The average sleep duration is now almost 2 hours shorter per night than 50 years ago, and this could be impacting our long-term health. For example, sleeping less has been linked with an increased risk of hypertension and cardiovascular problems generally. So by taking that nap, you can make a big difference. Now, here's what I do. Because I work very long hours, in the middle of the afternoon, I will shut my door, take a little thing that I can't offer you because I invented it myself. It's not for sale. But it's a little neck piece with magnets in it. And I lie down for about 15 minutes. 15 minutes on that, or just 15 minutes taking a nap, and preferably without a pillow, and on something firm. People have way too soft mattresses. That's why you have sore backs. But something firm, with your head completely down, 15 minutes, you can knock off almost an hour of sleep at night. So, one more reason to have that nap. Tomatoes. In Europe, they eat them a lot. In the United States, not so much. And the tomatoes we eat here are most always picked green, so they can all be picked at one time. And then an ethylene gas is blown on them, so they artificially ripen. Why do you think the tomatoes you buy in the stores never have any taste? In fact, I challenge you. I want you to take any tomato from a regular supermarket and take a bite out of it, and then take a bite out of some straw. And you tell me which is the tomato and which is the straw. There. In fact, I'll bet if by accident a tomato got into a baseball game, it could go 9 innings without being bruised. They are the worthless foods for a simple reason. You have to wait until you put your hand under a tomato and you feel it's moist at the bottom and heavy. Then you know that it's been vine ripened. The same way with a peach. When you know that you've got a full color and it's heavy, that's when you know the peach is right. But they are picking peaches immature. Everything's picked immature instead of allowing it to go natural. Something else I'm doing as an experiment this year. The first of the citrus on my farm, my ranch down in Florida, came out in November. Last year came out the first week of December. I was able to harvest the last of the citrus, grapefruit, orange, and lemon, in September. Now, mind you, that meant that I went 10 months with fruit on the trees, and I never picked anything. Each morning when I was there, I would pick it up off the ground, downers, put it in the refrigerator, and then use it, and it'll last for weeks and weeks once you refrigerate it. If you have fruit on the tree, let it stay on the tree. The longer you let it stay, the better it's going to be. Now, if you should happen to have figs, you throw a simple black netting over the tree. That way the birds won't get to it. Because the first time a bird sees the color change, they know it's ripe and they eat it. And that's why you have to be quick. So anyhow, back to tomatoes. Now, here's the deal with tomatoes. This is from Science Daily, from the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine. Eating more tomatoes and tomato products can make people healthier and decrease the risk of cancer, osteoporosis, and cardiovascular disease. Of all the non-starchy vegetables, actually, they got this wrong. Tomatoes are a fruit, not a vegetable. Americans eat more tomatoes and tomato products than they used to. And the research found that tomatoes are the biggest source of lycopene, an antioxidant that is very powerful. But when you cook the tomato, you make it more bioavailable, meaning the nutrients are better able to get into your body, and that can turn off inflammation. So tomato juice helps turn off inflammation, and that's also true for tomato soup. You can turn off inflammation. And a nice recipe for tomato soup is you cook your tomatoes lightly, and instead of using anything other than about, maybe cover the tomato just to the top, and then let the tomato heat for about a half hour. Then the skin comes right off of it. Then you put it into a blender, you puree it, you put it back in there, but now you add some rice milk or almond milk or soy milk, and then add the following seasonings. I cube up a little bit of mushrooms, and I put mushrooms in. Best I have found are white cap mushrooms, but you could also use shiitake. And then sweet onion, and then some cayenne pepper, black pepper, which is pepperine, which is very, very good for your system, very healing anti-inflammatory. And if you want a little of the pink Himalayan sea salt, that's okay, because it's got minerals also in it. And then let that heat for a while, and then finish it off with some fresh basil on top. A delicious soup, very good for you, and fully alive. Nothing dead, everything vibrant. Next up, those pecans. Rich in antioxidants. This is from the Journal of Nutrition. Quote, our tests show that eating pecans increases the amount of healthy antioxidants in the body. This protective effect is important in helping to prevent development of various diseases like cancer and heart disease. That was from a Dr. Ella Haddad, professor in the School of Public Health, Loma Linda University. So, what you can do to make it easy is this. When you make your health drink in the morning, and you have all your different, whether it's bananas or berries or powders, and of course, always put your teaspoon of cold organic pressed coconut oil and flaxseed oil, then throw a giant tablespoon of pecan butter in there one day, and then macadamia nut butter a different day, then walnut butter, then pistachio butter, all raw butters, loading the body with antioxidants and nutrients, phytonutrients. Also good for those of you who want to prevent a major type of cancer, malignant cancer. Quote, antioxidants can prove a powerful new weapon in the fight against the rare form of cancer, malignant mesothelioma, according to researchers at Thomas Jefferson Hospital and Kimball Cancer Center, Philadelphia. Consumers have long valued antioxidants, which can combat oxidative stress at the cellular level. Quote, fruits such as blueberries, apples, cranberries, strawberries, cherries, and plums are particularly high in antioxidants. Now, researchers at Kimball Cancer Center have linked the antioxidants to being able to reduce oxidative stress, and that can help, quote, the suppression of cancers such as mesothelioma. So that's good. And, of course, I believe that we should have antioxidants in tablet form, because that way we can get a standardized amount every day, throughout the day, five times a day. And then rich in juices, that's our antioxidants. And then in our compounding auric high supplements, that gives you a triple amount of antioxidants, all of which are working naturally in your body. From Elizabeth Walling, 9 reasons to eat more sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are good for you, too. They're packed with nutrition, 1 through 9. Sweet potatoes are high in antioxidants, and they're anti-inflammatory. They help with asthma, arthritis, gout. Sweet potatoes are an excellent source of carbohydrates. For those with blood sugar problems, this fibrous root vegetable can help regulate blood sugar and prevent conditions like insulin resistance. Sweet potatoes are healthy for your digestive tract. Sweet potatoes are good for those who are pregnant and trying to conceive because they're high in folate, which is essential for the development of fetal cell and tissue. Packed with important vitamins, eating sweet potatoes boosts your immunity. Sweet potatoes are good for preventing heart disease, high in potassium, and can help prevent the onset of a heart attack or stroke. And potassium also helps maintain fluid and electrolyte balance in the body. Sweet potatoes help alleviate muscle cramps. Sweet potatoes are good for treating stress-related symptoms, and sweet potatoes are ranked number one in nutrition of all our vegetables by the Center for Science and Public Interest. So, sweet potatoes are good. And want to do something kind of fun? Why don't you caramelize oranges, and then after you've cooked your sweet potato, open it up inside, and then put your caramelized orange inside of that, baste it in so it's completely covered, then sprinkle coconut shreds over that. That's good. Yeah. And finally, apples. Well, we know how good they are. This is from the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, and it says from Science Daily, scientists are reporting the first evidence that consumption of a healthy antioxidant substance in apples extends the average lifespan, in this case in test animals, by up to 10%. That's good news. And they've isolated the phytonutrients. But then it turns out those phytonutrients in the apple, well, gee whiz, they're also in tomatoes, broccoli, blueberries as well. So, they're called polyphenols. And you already know about polyphenols. That's what extends our life. So, my suggestion, peel a bunch of apples. Throw those apple skins into a blender. Throw in a little vitamin C. Put in some tart Montmorency cherry concentrate. Then put in some orange, grapefruit, and lemon juice from whole, fresh orange, grapefruits, and lemons. Turn it on for 60 seconds, drink that down, and you've given yourself a tremendous boost of healthy nutrition for the day. I'm Gary Knoll. We have a lot to share, and we're going to do our issue segment. Then we're going to go to our guest and have you share your points of view first. Two issues that I'm going to... Let me go first to our environmental section. This is from John LaForge from Common Dreams. Quote, French scientist, childhood leukemia really spikes near nuclear reactors. I'll quote this. French researchers have confirmed that childhood leukemia rates are shockingly elevated among children living near nuclear power reactors. The International Journal of Cancer, which, by the way, is a major respected journal, has published just today a scientific study establishing a clear correlation between the frequency of acute childhood leukemia and proximity to a nuclear power station. The paper, by the way, is entitled Childhood Leukemia Around French Nuclear Power Plants, the GEOCAP Study. This devastating report promises to do for France what a set of 2008 reports did for Germany, which recently legislated a total phase-out of all its power reactors by 2022. And the French epidemiology, conducted by a team from the Institute of National Sciences and three other organizations, did the research. So this was not any anti-nuke group doing the research. These were pro-nuke scientists, officials, doing official research and came up with this, and it's irrefutable proof. So, if that would be true in France, that living near a nuclear power plant would increase a childhood leukemia, that means it will increase other inflammatory and DNA-altering cancers. Hence, no child should be living within 20 miles of a nuclear facility. The trouble is, what if those nuclear facilities are right in the midst of large population groups, which they are in Chicago and New York? In which case, then, what are you going to do? You only have two options. A, deny there is any charge, or B, dismiss it by saying we need more studies, which means they kick this down the road, as they've done with every major problem. We need more studies on DDT. No, we didn't. We owe the banning of DDT to one person above and beyond all others. And she was a marine biologist, Rachel Carson. Today, we should have a Rachel Carson Day to celebrate the environmental movement. And who was more responsible for creating the EPA than any other person? Ralph Nader. I haven't forgotten all the good work that Ralph Nader has done, more than any other human being in American history, to protect us. So tomorrow, Ralph Nader will be on this program, along with Rocky Anderson. Not that Rocky can do anything. We've lost today's battle in this election. That's all right. But unlike all the other times where they could have created a platform for the future, this time, we're working towards 5 years from now, when there'll be many different Rocky Andersons, truly pro-populist people. And I'll be sharing tomorrow with Rocky Anderson 40 points to change America. 30 of those are up on my website as of today. Now for our issue of the day. There's actually two, and you can address either one. The first is short. It comes from Robert Cruikshank from Alternet. And it's entitled, Apple Driving Workers to Threaten Mass Suicide, The Pathologies of the Modern Corporation. And here's what it says. Here in my household, we're swimming in Apple products. We have four iPhones, although only three of them are currently in use. I have an iPad, an iPod, we have a MacBook. And I'm not an Apple fanboy. I just prefer products that work well, rarely ever crash, and help me create value. Apple products meet those needs perfectly, whereas most PCs I've used simply don't. If those were the only things I care about in life, I wouldn't give those products a second thought. But there's more to life than a functional piece of consumer electronics. Those items should exist to help me do the things in life that I want to do, to help me live a better life. They're tools, not ends. Even that's not sufficient. One of my main goals in life is to build a better world, to ease suffering, end depression, and provide equality, all in order that others may have the freedom to pursue their own dreams. In the last year or two, it's become increasingly clear that the way Apple makes its products is deeply flawed. Working conditions at the factory which makes most of their products, Foxconn in China, are so appalling that workers engaged in a rash of suicides last year to ameliorate their own suffering. Earlier this year, workers threatened mass suicide over pay and working conditions. And of course, there's the fact that Apple makes these products overseas rather than the United States, where unemployment remains at some of the highest levels we've seen since the Great Depression. Here in the 21st century, it should be clear to us that better technology is not sufficient to build the kind of better lives and society that we want. If it were, we wouldn't be in a position of mass unemployment, widespread suffering, and a democracy in decay. Social institutions, including workplaces and corporations, have to be full partners in building a democratic, empowering, and equal society. Most corporations, however, don't see themselves that way, including Apple. Today's New York Times took a look at Apple, America, and a squeezed middle class, curious to see why Apple no longer manufactures its products in the U.S. and what the impact is on our prosperity. They found that Apple builds in China in large part because they have a narrow focus on their product and their profits and disdain wider concerns for the good of society. When an unnamed Apple executive was asked about their role in addressing America's economic problems, their response was revealing. We sell iPhones in over 100 countries. We don't have an obligation to solve America's problems. Our only obligation is to make the best products. That quote is perhaps the best encapsulation of the pathologies of the modern American corporation. In fact, Apple does have an obligation to solve America's problems. Everyone who lives in this country has that obligation. And corporations have that obligation too. If they don't want to help make things better, then they shouldn't exist. Those are his thoughts. I'd like to hear yours, 888-874-4888. And finally, this is from Professor Paul Craig Roberts. Drowning in hypocrisy, unlimited amounts of money for war abroad, but austerity here at home. I'll quote this from Global Research. If it requires 11 aircraft carriers to deal with Iran, how many will Panetta, who's our Secretary of Defense, need to project power against Russia and China? But to get on with the main point, Iran has been trying to deal with us through diplomacy. The response from Washington has been belligerent threats of military attack, unfounded and irresponsible accusations that Iran is making a nuclear weapon, sanctions, and all oil embargoes. Washington's accusations echo Israel's and are contradicted by Washington's own intelligence agencies and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Why doesn't Washington respond to Iran in a civilized manner with diplomacy? Really, which of the two countries is the greatest threat to peace? Washington sends the FBI to raid the homes of peace activists and puts a grand jury to work to create a case against them for aiding a nebulous enemy by protesting Washington's wars. The Department of Homeland Security unleashes goon cop thugs to brutalize peaceful Occupy Wall Street demonstrators. Washington fabricates cases against Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and that negate the First Amendment by equating free speech with terrorism and spying. Chicago mayor and former Obama White House Chief of Staff Ron Emanuel pushes an ordinance that outlaws all public protests in the city of Chicago. And the list goes on. And in the midst of all this, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other Washington hypocrites accuse Russia and China of stifling dissent. Washington's grotesque hypocrisy goes unremarked by the American media and in the debates for the Republican presidential nomination. The corrupt Obama Justice Department turns a blind eye while goon cop thugs commit gratuitous violence against the citizens who pay the goon cop thugs undeserved salaries. But it is in the war crimes area where Washington shows the greatest hypocrisy. The self-righteous bigots in Washington are forever rounding up heads of weak states whose countries are afflicted by civil wars and sending them off to be tried as war criminals. All the while, Washington indiscriminately kills large numbers of civilians in six or more countries, dismissing it as no war crimes, just collateral damage. Washington violates its own law and international law by torturing people. Accountability? Zero. On January 13, 2012, Carol Rosenberg of McClatchy newspaper reported that Spanish judge Pablo Rafael Ruiz Gutierrez relaunched an investigation into Washington's torture of prisoners in Guantanamo prison. The previous day, British authorities opened an investigation into CIA renditions of kidnapped persons to Libya for torture. Rosenberg reports that although the Obama regime has refused to investigate the obvious crimes of the Bush regime, and one might add its own obvious crimes, quote, other countries are still interested in determining whether Bush-era anti-terror practices violated international law, unquote. There's no question that Bush, Cheney, Obama have trashed the U.S. Constitution, U.S. statutory law, and international law. But Washington, having overthrown justice, has established that might is right. No foreign government is going to send its forces to the United States to drag the war criminals here out and place them on trial. The War Criminal Court at The Hague is reserved for Washington's show trials. No foreign government is going to pay Washington several hundred million dollars to turn Bush, Cheney, Obama, or anyone else or their minions over to them in the way the U.S. bought Milosevic from Serbia in order to create the necessary spectacle of the war crimes tribunal to justify Washington's naked aggression in Serbia. No government can be perfect, because all governments are composed of humans, especially those humans most attracted to power and profit. Nevertheless, in my lifetime, I have witnessed an extraordinary deterioration in the integrity of government in the United States. We have reached the point where nothing that our government says is believable. Not the unemployment rate, not the inflation rate, not the gross domestic product growth rate, much less Washington's reasons for its wars, its police state, and its foreign and domestic policies. Washington has kept America at war for 10 years while millions of Americans lost their jobs and homes. War and the faltering economy have exploded the national debt, and a looming bankruptcy is being blamed on Social Security and Medicare. The pursuit of war continues. On January 23rd, Washington's servile puppets, the European Union member states, did Washington's bidding and imposed an oil embargo on Iran, despite the pleas of the Greeks and members of the European Union. Greece's final ruin will come from the higher oil prices from the embargo, as Greek government realizes. The embargo is a reckless act. If the U.S. Navy tries to intercede and intercept oil tankers carrying Iranian oil, large-scale war could break out. This, many believe, is Washington's aim. It is easy for an embargo to become a blockade, which is an act of war. Remember how easily the UN Security Council's no-fly zone over Libya was turned into a U.S. and its NATO puppets into military attacks on Libya's armed forces and population centers supportive of Gaddafi? As the Western democracies become increasingly lawless, the mask of law that imperialism wears is stripped away, and with it the sheen of morality that has been used to cloak power ambitions. With Iran surrounded, and with two of Washington's fleets in the Persian Gulf, another war of aggression seems inevitable. In conclusion, experts say that an attack on Iran by the U.S. and NATO will disrupt the flow of oil that the world needs. The crazed drive for power is so compelling that Washington and its European Union puppets show no hesitation in putting their own struggling economies at risk of sharply rising energy cost. Isn't it ironic? No amount of money is ever too much for our wars abroad. And yet, we are living under extreme austerity at home. That is the policy that is being imposed on a Western democracy. Craig Paul Roberts is the author. Those are his thoughts. Now it's time for yours. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. With us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our guests in about 7 or 8 minutes, but I did want to take some of your calls first on either of the two issues. And please feel free to call. It's an open forum, no censorship. 888-874-4888. And just two quick program announcements. I misspoke when I said that I would be meeting for a fundraising social mixer with music and poetry and just great conversation down this Saturday. It's the following Saturday. So I won't be there this Saturday from 1 to 4. I'll be there the following Saturday. Sorry for that. And next up is this Sunday. My lecture is full. If anyone cannot make it, and the weather's supposed to be nice, please call so that someone who wants to attend the lecture can be there. That's the lecture title is "This Is My Life, So I'm Going to Live It My Way." It'll be a powerful lecture, all new insights. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Good news! Yesterday, the station manager and program director both came up to our offices with an individual, a volunteer. We packed up all the books that I'd given as a free gift to the station to give to you, and those all went out yesterday. So I thank the station manager, I thank the volunteer, and Tony Bates for coming up and you will be receiving your book, Mind Power, probably in the next day or two. So, good news there. Also, all of the premiums that have been on back delay because of some financial shortages at the station, those were also picked up yesterday and they'll all be getting out. So, please understand we're all here to support 100% this important station. Even in its hour of need, that's when we have to even do more to help it in its time. So I'm glad to see that they're getting caught up. Now let's say hello to some of the people here. Let's go over to Long Island, and let's see who we have on Long Island. Greg, Greg, you're on the air.
Thanks, Gary. Love your show. I think one of the reasons why companies manufacture in China, especially Apple, is because we as a people have to decide, do we want cheap products or do we want our neighbors to work? Because you can't have both. If someone's getting paid 50 cents a day and the wage here plus insurance and sick and all that is $20, $30 an hour, an iPhone would be $6,000. So until we make a conscious effort as a whole to say we'd rather put our neighbors to work than to have cheap products, that's the only way that outsourcing is going to stop.
I appreciate your input. Let me share something that I would add on to that, Craig. What if we re-examine how we lived in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and through half of the 70s, where we were all part of communities, and you really were identified. When you'd walk down the street in your community, people would smile at you. There was a knowledge, a recognition. I remember a friend of mine walking who lived in Little Italy, and we walked down the street, and my friend stopped halfway down the block and said, "What do you see, Gary?" And I looked around, and I said, "I see a lot of buildings. I see people. See those women with a pillow in the window and leaning out? They'll do that all day long. And they all are looking. There's not a child on this block when they walk outside that's who their eyes are not on that kid. And do you think anyone's going to come in here and cause any problem? Not going to happen. They'd never get out of the neighborhood. You care about your neighborhood. You care about your family. You care about your friends. You are a part of something. And one of the things that we were all a part of in growing up as baby boomers were community. We've lost a lot of that today. Also, we've lost the idea that a worker's needs are important. We've placed the exclusive need of the corporation and its profits as singular. And if a worker's able, at a minimum wage, or close to it, to survive, even with two jobs and deep in debt, that's their problem. Instead of saying, why do we have to do business with China? We become a hostage to China. Well, simple reason. Because to continue our wars, to continue the enormous amount of debt that we create that does not benefit us, and there's a difference. It's fine to create debt if we benefit. It is not fine to create debt if we don't or only exclusive group do. Then we have allowed them access to our markets with the cheap products that they make that we used to make in the United States. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say, I'm going to buy a cheap product. I'm going to buy a pair of jeans at $30. But if those jeans are made in Bangladesh at 14 cents an hour in what amounts to a slave environment, that's okay. I'm getting my cheap jeans. I'm going to buy it at Walmart. But what if you were to buy a jeans made in the United States where a person made a decent living and you bought it from a small retail person, someone that you used to know, someone when you'd walk in their store, you could name their first name and they would know you? That means that you have to make some sacrifice. That means that you have to have a willingness to support, in some cases, a higher cost. But don't look at the cost as the final reason to buy something. Look at the fact that you're supporting American-made and your community, keeping a store in place that otherwise would go out, and then all you're going to have is mall stores, Walmarts, the Gaps, drugstores and banks. What about the small little mom-and-pop stores? So we have to realign ourselves with another set of priorities: community, neighbors, the interests of others. If we took that further in what I'm suggesting, when our neighbors were having trouble, we would go up and down the street and say, let's have some meetings to who's having trouble with your mortgage. And then together as a community decide, give them input. They have to make their choice. Is your house worth saving? And then all of us together go to the same bank and say, we're not going to pay any of our mortgages unless you bring the cost of this mortgage down to the value of the property. Or you take this and you take this out of foreclosure and allow the person to rent the house for a reasonable amount that they can afford. If you do it together, you have strength. If you don't do it together, then the day will come when you won't have any of those stores that you used to know as a kid. There won't be any things made in the United States. They'll all be made elsewhere by people who are working in unhealthy and unsatisfactory conditions, so you can have something cheap.
So then explain to me the disconnect. If I was on, I was at Wall Street a couple of times, when my work allowed, and on weekends. And I don't understand the disconnect between you have all these people protesting Washington, protesting Wall Street, protesting big banks, and then from Black Friday to Christmas, the 99% has spent $35 billion giving money to
Craig,
Wall Street and all those people.
You're absolutely right. But do you remember me also saying at some point the people at Occupy Wall Street have to let some adults into the room?
Yes.
Do you remember me saying that those of us who went down there and tried to share how the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the human rights movement, the apartheid ending in South Africa, how all these movements historically, what allowed them to progress, the leadership, the messages being on point, and that you can't have 1,000 people with 1,000 different messages and have any of those messages cause actual change, then the spectacle of just protesting becomes the movement's core instead of allowing a coalition to form the best ideas and take those forward. We have differences of opinions on the best way of moving something forward, but having been involved in hundreds of movements, I at least felt that it's good for people, whatever their reason, to protest when they see something wrong, but protest smartly and be sustaining it, and then you can see some results. So yes, I'm opposed to this whole idea of mass consumerism. I feel it's absolutely hypocritical that on the one hand say you're against Goldman Sachs, and then go out and keep your money in a Goldman Sachs bank account, or in your pensions in a trust fund used by a hedge fund to speculate in land in Africa, or to say that you're against the usurious rates on credit cards, but then seek the credit cards and use the credit cards that if you're late, even if you're not late, you're paying, they're getting it for zero from the Federal Reserve. You're giving them 29%, and that's if you pay on time, and then suddenly you're late and you're paying 50%. You don't have to use their credit cards. You don't have to be in their banks. You don't have to buy at their stores. You don't have to buy their jeans or televisions. You don't have to buy their cars. We do have freedom of choice in what we select. And unless we exercise that and have the spiritual discipline to exercise that, then just having protest without following up with actual concrete actions is just hypocrisy. Thank you very much. I appreciate your input, Greg. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. Colin Murphy, editor-at-large for Vanity Fair magazine and the former managing editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Some may remember the comic strip Prince Valiant, a series Colin worked on with his father. An expert scholar in the classics and medieval history, Colin is the author of several books, including The World According to Eve, Women in the Bible. He appeared on this program earlier to speak on the fall of the Roman Empire, and everyone liked that program. It's one of the most downloaded programs. And he's here to talk today about God's Jury, the Inquisition in the Making of the Modern World, which is an investigation into the psychology and methods of bureaucracy, power, persecution, and how the legacy of the Inquisition continues to live with us today in recent American history. Nice to have you back with us today, Cullen.
It's great to be back, Gary. Thank you.
I feel we need to first, if you would please, dispel some of the myths that most people, especially Americans, have about the Inquisition. And for most people, when we think of the Inquisition, we think of the burning of heretics and witches in Europe during the Middle Ages, or images from Monty Python. However, the Inquisition was more broad and more grand in its scale, not simply confined to the church, but also secular government, and it included several separate large sweeping operations, totaling 600 years when combined, and it was perhaps the first dynamic, organized bureaucracy of personal data collection and retrieval and policing and censorship and surveillance inflicted on large populations, and only now matched by our own government's bureaucratic security network monitoring the lives of people. So please begin begin with summarizing the scope of the Inquisition, and please focus on those characteristics and operations that we can attribute to the Church having first developed as a means for controlling populations, and also address the global scope of the Inquisition and the fact that it was not limited to Europe. For example, the Hindu residents in the Portuguese colony of Goa in India experienced a very brutal Inquisition, and very few people know that the Inquisition even reached the Americas in the 19th century in New Mexico and California.
Well, you've done a pretty good job encapsulating it yourself, Gary. And but let me take on some of the subjects you've laid out. You're absolutely right. People, I think, although everybody knows the word Inquisition and throws it around, most people don't really have a very good historical understanding of it. And further, I think many people, to the extent that they know anything about the Inquisition, they tend to think that this was something that is really confined to the past. It's over now. We can put it aside. We don't need to think about it. And my point is that this isn't something that's safely in the past, but rather it's a harbinger of things to come. Now, as you pointed out, the Inquisition went on for a long time. It started in the early 13th century, and it wasn't officially abolished by the papacy until 1908, which is a date that took me by surprise. And the targets of the Inquisition were many. I think most people know that Jews were a frequent and constant target, and that is true. But others were as well. Christian heretics of various kinds, Protestants. They were, as an entire group, regarded as heretics. Intellectuals, scientists, sometimes witches, ordinary people who happened to believe in certain superstitions. So it was very wide ranging. But let me break the Inquisition into two parts. One is about the way we think, and one is about the way we make what we think kind of operational. The part about what we think has to do with what I call moral certainty. And that's when any person or group believes it has a monopoly on the truth and believes so fervently that it has a monopoly on the truth that it thinks it has the right to impose that truth on everybody else for their own good. And that is not a characteristic that's limited to religion. You know, you see it in totalitarian regimes of the last century. You see it in various ways even now. And but that particular characteristic, moral certainty, is something that you really need to have if you're going to have a kind of inquisitorial activity. And then there's the other part, and I devote a lot of the book to this other part, and that is, if you're going to pursue something like this, this enterprise, you need some tools. People have hated one another and persecuted one another since antiquity. But often these persecutions, they die out because there's nothing to sustain them. You need things like a bureaucracy. You need to be able to administer what you're doing. You need record keeping. You need to be able to train personnel to do this kind of work. That's what you need if you're going to try to keep this going for generation after generation. And these kinds of tools, we take them for granted in our own time. But historically, one doesn't take them for granted. They had to be invented. And in the Middle Ages, you see these tools starting to become available. And it's because the Inquisition arises at a time when these tools are there, beginning to be developed, to be used, that it has the kind of staying power that it has. Does that get at some of the issues that you were asking about?
It sure does. I just don't think the average person realizes how meticulous people were keeping massive amounts of information on the people in their societies that would be used against these people if it was convenient for someone to charge someone with something, or and then all this information, meticulous, detailed information, was brought out. And then I'm looking at today. I'm looking at those individuals within the media who pronounce themselves the guardians of our moral fiber and what is politically correct. I remember when Bill O'Reilly was summoning up all of his, you know, power to say that we're in this war now, and if you're not on our side, then leave the country. And I thought, and who gave him the right to determine if we're against the war, which I and many others were, and rightly so, that how should he then demonize us? Now, I just, in that moment, I saw him as the great inquisitor, the man who comes in and says, you are guilty unless you can prove yourself innocent. And then I'm looking today, I'm looking at one of the best organized surveillance bureaucracies in the world that we've ever seen, and growing by leaps and bounds, with no effort on part of any of our major Congress legislation to stop. In fact, it continues to feed that.
Let me guess. Is it Google?
Yes.
you're absolutely right. And what you started out by noting, which is the information gathering capacity of the Inquisition, it really is astonishing when you go back. You know, these were folks who didn't have any sort of modern tools. They were using, you know, parchment, and but they were keeping vast quantities of records. And just for instance, there's one item that I reprint in my book, which is just the expense account for a burning at the stake, which gives everything down to the cost of the rope used to, you know, tie the victim's hands. But the information was about all kinds of things. And the inquisitors, you know, typically they would go to a town, they would call people in for questioning. Sometimes they would use torture. They would have a kind of a trial, and they would mete out sentences. And, you know, most people were not burned at the stake, but, you know, tens of thousands were. And, you know, this had an enormous psychological impact. But the amount of information that was gathered in the process is just extraordinary. It's, you know, it's been a boon to historians who are trying to figure out, well, what was life like back then, because the information is so detailed.
Could you give us...
And they had these training manuals, which are a fascinating subject in their own right, to teach someone how to be an interrogator.
Is it true or not that our army manuals make reference to the effectiveness of the Inquisition's methods and psychology of applying torture for achieving its goals?
The army manuals do not. There is a document that was done by an intelligence advisory board that actually does point to two interrogation manuals that were drawn up by the Inquisition, saying in effect these were the forebears of the techniques we use now. You know, the Army Field Manual is very painstaking in the way it says interrogation should be done, and it does not permit torture. But in terms of the psychological techniques that it uses, there's nothing that it suggests that hasn't been thought of already by the interrogators of the Inquisition.
When you look at our society today, do you puzzle over the fact that the average American is having much of their privacy invaded, their rights challenged, and yet there seems to be very little challenge to this?
I'm very troubled by it. And, part of the concern that I have, when you look back at the Inquisition, one thing that you become aware of is that, you know, over time, an awful lot of activity seems to be going on almost as if it's on autopilot. You know, it starts with a great amount of fear and concern, and we have to deal with this particular problem. This is on the part of the church. But then it becomes kind of bureaucratized. And we know what bureaucracies are like. They just go on and on and on, and people show up for work. They do their particular little job. They don't necessarily think about the picture. You know, and the next thing you know, 200 years have gone by, and this activity has been going on without anybody stepping in to stop it. And we're in a situation like that today, I think, in a number of ways. And one of them simply has to do with surveillance. This is something that's going on, every single second in the lives of every single one of us. And we rarely pause to think about it. We take very few steps to try to control it. It may be that it can't be controlled, and it takes on a kind of life of its own. I think that's actually extremely troubling.
You made a comment earlier that I'd like for you to follow up on. It's as if the Inquisition, for me, represents particularly collective psychology of those wielding power and control according to a particular ideology that lives in the Manichaean universe of absolute right and everything else is wrong. And this is a theme we repeatedly hear by our politicians, not just government, but all dominant factions in a discipline, such as big pharma, big agri, big fossil fuels, big banking, all of which are like extensions of big government that protect them and unites them in a single, all-encompassing church. So would you give us a clearer picture of the kind of psychology that gave birth to the Inquisition, its ultimate motivations, and then compare that with what we are witnessing today in government and the media and big business and finance all united?
Yeah, well, I think you've put your finger on it. It is a Manichaean view. There is one right path, and everything else is, in some sense, evil, or if not evil, wrong. And, it's tempting nowadays, and you'll hear this sometimes, where people will say, oh, well, the great forces that tried to impose a particular point of view are gone. The church doesn't have the power that it used to have. Communism doesn't have that power. Fascism doesn't have that power. And that's certainly true. But the propensity for human beings to embrace some form of certainty as the one true path, that has not disappeared. And you see it in all kinds of ways. You see it when people rise up and say, we want to ban these books from libraries. When you see it when just to take the a governmental example, in the aftermath of 9/11, which was a traumatic event that to which we needed to respond. But the idea took hold in some quarters that anything that you did to respond to the threat of terrorism was justified. That there was no more important consideration than that one thing. And once you're seized with that idea, it causes you to brush aside many other considerations that are extremely important and that go to the heart of our values. And this is one of the mindsets, in my view, that led to us using techniques that amounted to torture, or that were torture. And it all traces back to this notion that what I'm doing is absolutely right, I'm completely justified, I don't need to think about everything else, and there is nothing more important.
You've done a masterful job in a provided a great service to all of us. I'm hopeful that people in this audience will read God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World, because only by reading it and then looking around us can we realize, oh my goodness, we have stepped over that line. And Colin Murray, I look forward to our next conversation.
I do too. Thanks very much for having me back, Gary.
Thank you. Colin Murphy, my guest. I'm Gary Noll, and I want to thank you all for listening. Just before we go out here, and we'll be followed by Mike Fader, we have Elizabeth in studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We have a quick question here from Jane in Houston in Texas. She's 43. Every day she listens to the show, she's already beginning to lose some short-term memory. You discussed nutrients for the brain in one of your past shows, and she's just asking, could you repeat those, please?
Phosphatidylserine, acetyl L-carnitine, phosphoglycerolcholine, ginkgo biloba, a niacin at non-flush levels, B12 at 1 milligram of methylated, folate at 1 gram, 1 milligram of that and 1 milligram for B12 methylated levels, coenzyme Q10 at 3 to 500 milligrams, and NADH at 100 milligrams. Those would be a good starting place to help in retrieving one's memory and creating, along with alpha-lipoic acid, 1,000 milligrams synucleidendrite, which are the lines that connect neurons. They get snapped when you have alcohol or fried food, and that's what prevents memory. The memory is never lost. No one can ever forget anything, ever. How we retrieve it is the key, and helping to reconnect the lines that allow a proper transmission from point A to point B is what we should focus on.
Thank you.
Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's show. Have a nice day, everyone.
Your home, done lost your woman. And